Over the generations, there have been some pretty remarkable boat sinking tales over the years. The first one that might come to mind is the Titanic. But did you know that Newcastle has their very own, the Helen B. Sterling? What happened? Tell me it has a happier ending. Let's find out. Greg Ray is the owner and writer of historical website Photo Time Tunnel. Good morning.
Hello, Kaya. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Pretty good.
Good. Tell me, I didn't know we had our own shipwreck story. What do we know?
Oh, this is such an amazing story. I really love it. There was a youngster named Leslie Harris, who was a school pupil at Stockton Primary School. He was 10 years old, and it was 1922. And his father was a skipper of a ship, actually a big schooner, called the Helen B. Sterling. And that had an American owner, and it used to bring timber to Australia and New Zealand from the US and take coal back. So it seems that Leslie's father, George, decided it would be really nice to take some of his family on one of his voyages. So Leslie and Mum Edith got on board with Dad George, and I think there was a total of 18 aboard, including two women. So it was January the 5th, 1922, they left Newcastle to take coal, ultimately to San Francisco. Mm. And so, as Leslie's written account says, the second day out, they had the first sign of a bit of bad luck. They had a fire aboard that burnt a beam on the ship.
Oh, no.
That was nasty. Then on 9th of January, they had a gale that blew away a sail, and that was pretty scary. But then they hit a cyclone. And so they're in the Tasman Sea, and they get this cyclone, and it just went for days. And as Leslie wrote in his What I Did in My Holidays account for his teacher, these mountainous waves were just crashing over both sides of the ship, meeting in the middle and filling the ship up. Well, the next thing that went wrong was that the pump engine failed. So all hands to the pumps, so they're trying to manually pump the water out of the ship, but it's filling up faster than they can pump, and the crew are all getting exhausted from pumping. Anyway, also aboard was a radio operator. They were really, really, really lucky. One of the few sailing ships at the time that had a radio. It was considered to be a pretty extravagant luxury. Anyway, Raymond Shaw was the radio operator. And he'd been working the pumps like crazy all day, January 21, through the cyclone. He went to bed soaking wet because the engine had gone. And during the night, he hears this crashing and bashing against the ship. And at dawn, he sees it's the mainmast has come crashing down.
Oh, no.
And it's still joined to the ship by cables, and it's just belting against the ship. Anyway, they cut it free, and his first thought was, oh, no, my radio aerial. And he's looked up, and luckily it hadn't been brought down by the mast, which was an incredible fluke, because in a previous voyage they'd had a little bit of an accident with the mainmast, and it had been shortened by a metre. If it had been its full height, it would have carried the aerial away. So he had to get onto the radio and try and send out SOS signals. And so for hours and hours, he's pounding away on his SOS keys. And he had a bit of trouble because that was run by a little generator. His radio set was run by a little generator, and every now and then it would fail, and he'd have to crawl through into the engine room and rehook this little drive belt back onto it. And he had to do that so often that eventually they got an injured sailor to just stay in there and hold the drive belt on the generator with a bit of wood so that it could keep running. And so all these SOSs are going out, and it seemed like they're just going out into the ether with no one hearing them. But luckily for them, insanely lucky, HMAS Melbourne, the Australian Navy cruiser, was on its way to New Zealand for some exercises, and they picked up this SOS signal, and they immediately just dropped everything and said, right, we're going. Mm. They were 340 kilometres away, and they had to go across stormy seas. They had barely enough coal aboard to get there. They calculated that if they couldn't find the ship by 2 a.m., they'd have to turn around and go back. Anyway, they got up as much steam as they possibly could and just went hell for leather toward where they hoped they might find this schooner. They didn't really know for sure exactly where it was, but, you know, they did their best. Anyway, so meanwhile, poor old Raymond Shaw, the radio operator aboard the Helen B. Sterling, is having all sorts of trouble. Now his batteries are going flat, and he had to go and scavenge some batteries that are normally used for lighting to try and hook them up. And everything was getting wet. The drive bolt was getting wet and slipping, so then he had to work out a way of... He coated it with varnish to make it tighter. And so somehow or other, he's managing to just keep this radio limping along to get this signal out.
Meanwhile, we should say the boat is being battered by cyclonic conditions, so that is still happening outside.
Oh, yeah, they had, like, they had 8 inches of freeboard, so that this thing was just, like, almost sunk. It's just lying really low in the water. The mast is gone. The sails are all gone. the thing's just wallowing like a big lump. And everyone is just... The crew eventually were coming to Raymond and saying, can you send me a farewell message to my family?
Aww.
Yeah, so they thought they were goners. And, you know, the two ladies aboard, they were in the cabins downstairs, and they'd virtually just given up on it. They sort of thought, look, if the end comes, that's it. There's nothing we can do. The lifeboats can't survive. At one point, they did call everyone up on deck. They said, right, we're going to try and launch the lifeboats. They tried to get one over, but it was immediately smashed by the heavy seas. So they thought, well, that's it. We can't. The lifeboats can't survive. Our only hope is this this warship that theoretically is heading towards us.
Mm.
Anyway, aboard the warship, Captain Feeks was very determined to find them, and he just kept on steaming. Poor old Raymond, his radio is just about dead. He's got hardly any battery left, and now, even worse, he's realized that he's got no more generator oil. He's got a little bit left, so he has to stop signaling, and he says, look, I'll signal again at midnight, and, you know, hopefully, if we're still afloat, you might be closer. So, at 11:45, he reopens the radio for his last attempt to get in touch with the Melbourne. And meanwhile, the Melbourne are going, look, we've got almost no coal. We're going to have to start thinking about going back. This has been really good, but, you know, it's a good try, but maybe we're not going to be able to do it. The captain said, look, last thing, our most powerful signaling lamp, I want you to shine it all around the horizon quickly and, you know, just as powerful as you can do it. Anyway, Raymond on the radio goes, oh, my God, I see this white finger of light shining. I can see your light.
No!
Yeah. And he said, okay, right. Well, now we know where you are. Okay, so he gave the position, and they actually managed to get alongside. And then another heroic effort, they launched a boat. They got 12 volunteers to go into this longboat to row toward the Helen B. Sterling. Then they had to get a line aboard, which was a tremendous effort. Then, and luckily they had, the Melbourne was there with a massive searchlight to illuminate all this. Then they had to get everyone off one by one along this line on this strange rescue device called a britches buoy, which is just like a pair of pants hanging off a pulley. And you slip yourself into this pair of canvas pants, and they drag you through the water into the boat. Anyway, it took 2 hours of hard work to get all the people off, and you can just imagine, can't you, getting dragged through this cyclonic conditions into this boat, which was then dangerously overloaded. And so the captain was the last one off, and our poor old Leslie, 10-year-old Leslie, he was panic-stricken because he was so scared he was never going to see his sisters again, but he was also upset he was going to lose his cats. So the first mate tried to throw the cats into the lifeboat in a pillowcase. One of them was lost, but one of them actually survived. And, so this extraordinary rescue, they got all the people off the Helen B. Sterling safely, like a needle in a haystack job, in the most extraordinary conditions, and then got them safely to New Zealand and then ultimately back home, where Leslie had the opportunity to write one of the most spectacular What I Did in My Holidays compositions for his teacher.
I bet you the teacher was not expecting that at all.
No. I hope he got a good mark.
What do we know happened to the ship, to the vessel?
Well, it it basically bobbed around, barely afloat for a little bit longer, and then no one really knows after that. I think the wreckage of it was spotted sort of almost completely sunk. Really, there was no prospect of people staying alive on it any longer.
Mm.
So it eventually sunk. One interesting point was when Leslie was hauled aboard in the Britches Buoy onto the Melbourne, or lifted from the lifeboat into the Melbourne, the man that grabbed him was a Novocastrian by the name of Harry Dagwell. Yeah.
It is always Newcastle and the Hunter is such a small world. You'll always run into someone from the Hunter no matter where you are in the world.
That's right. Anyway, Leslie grew up and he became a foreman boilermaker at Newcastle State Dockyard. He died in 1984. And 3 years after that, one of his grandsons, Michael, joined the Royal Australian Navy, and the first ship that he served on was the most recent incarnation of HMAS Melbourne.
Amazing, amazing. How did you come across this story, Greg?
Well, it's been reported before, and I guess I just kind of just found different accounts of it and pieced them all together. Like it's particularly lovely to Paul Harris, actually, sorry, a descendant of Leslie. He very generously let me photograph Leslie's school composition. And so then also Raymond Shaw, he had his account published in a thing called the Smith's Weekly.
Mm-hmm.
There were also the New Zealand papers were all over it. They wrote it up in a big way. And a lot of this stuff now is available on the National Library's Trove site. So if you know what you're looking for and you know the dates, you can find all these different accounts and you can piece all the parts of the jigsaw together and get the, you know, a reasonably full picture. And in this case, it really makes it an extraordinary story to get the account from the schoolboy and the radio operator and the skipper of the Melbourne.
I love how good we were at keeping things back in the day, you know, at holding on to that handwritten school assignment that Leslie would have handed in to his teacher. The fact that we still, you know, that was still around to be able to see and photograph and keep is, you know, a really essential part of the story as well.
Absolutely gorgeous. And I love, you know, he just writes it so matter-of-factly. You think, wow, what a cool, calm and collected kid.
Yeah. Greg, so great to have you share this story with us this morning. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you, Kaya.
Greg Ray there, owner and writer of historical website Photo Time Tunnel. That's where you can see a little bit of Leslie's letter as well. It is quite long. It is beautifully written. It just starts with, "Dear Miss Monaghan, this is the story of my voyage and wreck. Safe home once again, and it all seems mysterious." You know, like when something big happens to you and it's done, and you think, did that actually happen?